This is Rachel Seidman. Today is Friday, April 22nd, 2016. I'm here at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with Patina Park, who's the executive director. And we are undertaking a oral history interview for the project currently called hashtag feminism, speaking up and talking back in the digital age. So Patina, I'm going to ask you to start by just telling me what you know about your grandparents. Do you know them?
I do. I should let you know I'm adopted. So okay. I actually have more than one set of grandparents now. On my biological father's side, I was able to meet my grandmother, Viola, 2 years ago, I think it is now. She was married. My grandfather was Scottish, actually a Scottish national, so he had dual citizenship, and they met in the military. So she unfortunately passed from a stroke last year in March. So, but I was very grateful I got to actually meet her. I guess it would have been like 3-4 years ago that I met her. On my mother's side, my biological mother's side, her parents have both passed on, so I didn't know them other than see a few pictures. So I don't know much about them at all, other than they were very big people, like very tall and wide looking, very like Russian German. On my adopted side, my mother's parents had her when they were 40, above 40. And so she was obviously an only child, and all of her friends or her parents' friends had grown kids by then. So she grew up as a little adult, but they passed. My grandfather, maternal grandfather, would have passed. Oh, I think I was a few months old. And then my grandmother died when I was 3. But I have pretty strong memories of her because I would go over to her house and she would make homemade butterscotch pudding for me. And she had just this white, white hair because she apparently went prematurely gray in her 30s, but always had just this gorgeous, curly, white hair. She died within a few months of my brother dying, too. So I know it was a really rough time on my mother because her parents moved up to North Dakota when my mother and father moved from Oklahoma. So that's her side. Now, my dad's side... my grandma's name was Kenneth because they thought she was going to be a boy. And when she came out a girl, they didn't change anything. So my father's mother was raised pretty much as a boy growing up. She died, let's see, I want to say eight years ago because my youngest was just a little over a year. Passed when she was in her 90s. So she was on the very first, one of the first women's professional basketball teams, according to her. Who knows? Never verified anything. But apparently she was a really good athlete. The half court is what they played then. But as a result, neither of her sons, my dad or his brother, play sports because she could kick their butt. And she was like 5 feet tall. I mean, she was this little bitty person. And so both of them, neither of them got into sports because they were embarrassed by the fact that she could beat them at sports. Her husband, Jürgen, he passed away probably, I think when I was about 6, maybe 5 or 6. Y-E-A-R-G-I-N. Oh, no, he was older because, let me think. The elections would have been like in 78, I think, right? Because I know I had to go down and spend a couple weeks at my grandparents because my father was running for office, and so while he was doing that I stayed, so that would have been 78, so he would have died in 79. So but he was a farmer, a dairy farmer. He had one of the largest dairy farms in Oklahoma at the time. Also had oil wells, everybody does down there. So I have a lot of memories of driving around with him in his car, and he would let me drive. You know, he'd put me in his lap and I'd steer to go check the oil wells and make sure everything was okay. But I only saw them on the summer. Like my mother's parents, I saw all the time, at least her mother, but the others only saw in the summer.
So you grew up with your adopted
mm-hmm.
parents?
Yeah, they adopted me at birth.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
First 12 years in Steele, North Dakota, and then moved to Bismarck.
Okay.
Until I moved away after high school.
Okay.
So North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. And how would you describe your home growing up?
Oh, it was great. I mean, I grew up on a farm for the first 12 years, so very independent. I would get up at the crack of dawn with my dad when he'd go out to feed the cattle, and I'd go horseback riding. You know, so there's pictures of me on horses where my legs are straight out because mm-hmm. I wasn't even big enough for my legs to go around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember going horseback riding for hours first thing in the morning, and I wasn't in school yet, so I must have been, you know, 4 or 5. I tease my parents now. I'm like, yeah, that's a child protection case. I mean, if people knew. But, yeah, I would spend hours. I'd only come home to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, my dad working on the farm and my mom busy raising, you know, the kids. I spent a lot of time by myself, but in a farm, it's awesome.
Mm. How many siblings did you have?
At that time, I was the youngest. I have a sister who's 12 years older. I had a brother who was 18 months younger than she was, but he passed away of muscular dystrophy, which was the son that died when my mother's mother died, when he was 15. And then I have a brother, Philip, who's 6 years older than me. So there would have been the four of us at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom had wanted a huge family because she was an only child, but she had a lot of miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
And my oldest, or my brother, Philip, who's 6 years older than me, he was born butt first, folded in half. And it was too late to do anything, so she got her tubes tied
mm-hmm.
after that, which is why I came along and was adopted.
Because
she couldn't have children anymore at that
point. Okay. How would you describe yourself as a young person?
I mean, happy, you know, but a loner for sure. I mean, because most of the time, unless I was in school, I was just playing and wandering around
mm-hmm.
the house by myself. I know when I was, when my mother's mother died, she had, I think it was kidney cancer, but she had some kind of abdominal cancer, I remember. And so she was at home. My mother was caring for her during that time. And so I do remember having to be like quiet,
mm-hmm.
like not. So I'd spend more time outside than in because it's apparently very painful. It's the most painful cancer you can have. So she was, I can remember the syringes. She must have been on morphine or something while she was caring for her. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I spent all my days outside running around nonstop, you know, riding horse, riding at three-wheelers, you know, playing imaginary games, you know, in the fields, because we had a very large farm, so it was independent but fun.
Yeah. And then when you got to high school, were you a studious person? Were you a...
let's see. By then we'd moved to the big city, so that was a huge transition to go from a class where we were considered the big class, and I think I had... We were a baby boom in the 1970, so I think... We had like 24 students all together. I mean, they split us into two groups. Whereas I moved into Bismarck and my junior high, you know, seventh grade had hundreds of kids. So it was quite a shock. I mean, my biggest memory of moving to the big city is everyone kept talking about this thing called MTV. And they were doodling it. I mean, I had no idea what it was. Because on the farm, we had CBS and NBC. That's it. There were no other channels. You just didn't watch TV. And when I moved to the big city, everybody watched TV. MTV.
What was behind the move?
My dad was appointed the state dairy commissioner. And had been doing the commute.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother graduated from high school. And at that point, they just didn't want to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom had started working part-time doing taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And so she actually found a job in town, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so they both moved in and we lived close, so they didn't have to go.
Because
it's about an hour commute.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I do that every day now. I live in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
So I drive farther now than my dad used to drive from the farm. But it seemed like a very long ways back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were you... planning to go, well, that move must have been pretty, how did it feel for you as a kid?
I would come into town once a week anyway because I was taking dance classes.
When my mother's mother died, she left money in her will for me to dance, because I used to dance even when I was little, as soon as I could move. And so I would come into town. So I had some friends who were already here that I knew from dance class. But I just remember kind of being in a daze. I mean, now I can appreciate, too, like how the Asperger's kind of played into where I missed stuff. Probably didn't know better, but also had this strong sense of being in a foreign land, that they had rules and stuff that I did not understand at all. Mm-hmm. And then my good friend that I went to school there with, she became a cheerleader, and I didn't, and that like created a social divide too. So high school was, I was in theater. I danced all through high school. I went to college dancing until I hurt myself. So I was with the theater kids, you know, the freaks, the crazy people, you know, and I was very content. You know, I had a lot of fun in high school. I enjoyed it immensely. Mm-hmm. But I certainly wasn't part of the popular kids, mm-hmm. and, you know, had instances where they'd write stuff on my locker and throw things at me in the hall. And, you know, I wasn't, like, the high school wasn't great, but the experience overall, I had fun. Mm. I had good friends.
And how do you understand the bullying? Was that
It was because, well, we weren't in sports. Like, sports was the big thing. Wrestling and hockey were huge. I also had a really good friend from junior high who now lives in Colorado with his wife and their kids. The problem was, at that time, he hadn't transitioned. So he was Raina, and it was a woman, and because we were good friends and in theater, I mean, it really was kind of peripheral picking on, because they just really never left him alone, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. High school, I'm sure if you asked him, was horrible, mm-hmm. absolutely horrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was with musicians and the theater people and the dancers, and so... Yeah, we kind of just stuck together. And, you know, at the 10-year reunion, I'll never forget one of the, like, popular kids saying, oh, you know, you guys were so cool. I wanted to be just like you. I'm like, oh, really? That's funny. That's not how you acted. So, cool. That's great. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And were your adopted parents Native American?
My dad is an enrolled member of the Osage Nation out of Oklahoma. My mom is Native, but enough to be enrolled anywhere. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everyone in Oklahoma kind of considers themselves Native, because the population is so huge down there. Mm-hmm. And there's so many tribes in a small state. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, most people are.
Mm-hmm. But in school, that wasn't part of how you understood the bullying, a racial...
Oh, no, it was not racial. No one knew. Mm-hmm. No one even assumed, mm-hmm. at all. I can remember a very vivid moment when I was... One of my best friends was named Amy, and she lived close to me, and we'd hang out at each other's houses. And I was at her parents were home, and her dad kind of went off on this tangent and... venting about drunken Indians that had been down at this. There was this one bar in downtown, which was more likely to be Indians going there, but though most people there were white and drunk, but whatever. But I remember just sitting there thinking, my dad doesn't drink at all. I like not being able to put what he was saying in any kind of context to my experience. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any drunken Indians at that time, any. So mm-hmm. I had no idea what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. But once Amy told him later that I was Native, he didn't really want me coming around anymore after that. But we remained good enough friends that she followed me her second year of college and lived with me, mm-hmm. down at Arizona State. Mm-hmm. So
you ended up going to college in order to dance? Was that your plan to...
Yeah, Arizona State at the time had one of the top public school programs, and I knew I couldn't afford... the private ones, mm-hmm. you know, like William and Mary had the best one, but there was no way I could go to, mm-hmm. William and Mary. And I had a good friend that lived there with her family. She was a senior in high school, so I actually lived with her, mm-hmm. that first year, because, mm-hmm. I never did the dorms. There was no way I was gonna, mm-hmm. ever do the dorms.
Why?
I would have no control over who that person is, and to have to live with them, no, mm-hmm. absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was college like for you?
Well, it was kind of a secondary kind of job to me most of the time. I worked full time in addition to going to school. And I hurt myself. Like I took the first year I only went part time. And then the second year I was there, I went full time in the dance program. Mm-hmm. And then the following year I hurt myself right away. Mm-hmm. And so they let me like continue the classes. You know, I spent a year in physical therapy and I had two surgeries and all this, but finally my orthopedic doctor and my PT was like, yeah, this is as good as it gets. I'm sorry, but you can't replace an ankle. And I hurt my ankle. Mm. And if it was your knee, your hip, we could do something. But so I had to change my major, and that's why I changed to psychology. I mean, the idea of leaving college was never even in my head. I mean, because for my parents, going to college was an absolute. So I knew they would not have supported my decision if I had decided to leave. But in retrospect, I probably should have taken time off and stepped away. But while I was going to college, even as a psychology major, I was working part-time in a women's clinic and ended up managing the front desk and the front office. So I managed the front, and then the nurse managed the clinic. But we did abortions too. So it was, you know, mostly serving Native American and, you know, Mexican women, actually, were our highest cash. We didn't take insurance. And I did counseling, I did phlebotomy. I mean, you just do kind of a little bit of everything. But I was doing that while I was going to school.
Well,
so college was never like a primary thing I did.
And how had you gotten interested in the women's clinic?
Oh, it's funny. I started dating someone I met at a Halloween party, and his mother ran it. And they needed a front desk person. And then once I got there, I just felt like so, like I was in with my people, kind of. I just fit. That I stayed with them for all through the whole time I was in school.
So what did that mean to you? You were with your people.
Well, they were, you know, kind of misfits too. You know, not had kind of a different framework of thinking about how people should behave. You know, no judgment, just kind of open minded. You know, you really do working. I would say, like, if I did not work in an abortion clinic because I felt the strong, you know, at all. I mean, I worked there because it was convenient. And then once I got there, I absolutely supported everyone's right to make their decision. There's no other way I can think of to be. I like, people are anti-choice. I have trouble getting my head around people who try to take their framework of looking at things and place it on someone else. You know, I mean, it's illogical. I mean, if you don't believe in it, don't do it is the logic. And too much of that is not logical at all. But no, they were a great group of people. We had so much fun. I mean, it was fun going to work, even though it was very stressful. And it felt good knowing we were helping people. You know, even the daily aggravation with the picketers was almost like bonding as a group, you know, because we all had to deal with those people who would then use the clinic when it was convenient and then go back out picketing, you know, after their 2-week check. I mean, it was amazing to me how many people did it, like the hypocrisy of people.
Use had the clinic never, for what?
Oh, they'd have their abortion because they were God's only exception. It was okay for them.
Really?
And oh, all the time. All the time. Yes, absolutely. All the time. It was not okay for anyone else, but when they found themselves pregnant, more often times than not, we would be serving former picketers or people who would become picketers. Because then they've given themselves the forgiveness, because now they feel bad about it because they're picketing and preventing other people from doing it. Those people used to drive me crazy, but we'd still serve them and be compassionate, you know, because either you believe people have that right to make the decision, what's best for them, or you don't, and you don't get to classify or judge people based on whether they fit some certain mold or not.
And so did you, what years were those?
I worked at the clinic from 1989 through 95. Because that's how long I was in college, actually, from 88 to 95. Because I lost year and a half of credits, almost 2 years of credits, because the dance credits don't pass to anything. And then I didn't go full time. So it took 7 years to finally get my psychology degree.
So did you, I'm pretty sure, I think there were was at least one, you know, big march on Washington for women's reproductive rights mm-hmm. during that time. Did you participate in that mm-hmm. kind of thing?
No, there would have been no funding for us right. to do that sort of thing. I would if I'd given the opportunity, but, you know, even I'm getting, my mindset is getting more at the point of activism rather than just advocate. I've always seen myself as an advocate for the one. And so, for me, it's always been more important to be there helping the individual with that whole process, even here, like the one, or when I was practicing law, than to be out on the streets hollering for the whole. Like, supporting that and realizing that's definitely a role and a position and something that has to be done, but that it's really two separate, like, talents or mindsets. Because I find a lot of times people who kind of activists for the whole have lost sight of the individuals that are actually impacted. Like, they don't really know the stories of the ones whose rights they're trying to enforce. And that's fine, because at a policy level, the individual may not be as important. I've always been more about the individual.
Where do you think that comes from?
I don't know, actually. I really don't know. A sense of, like I said, I was a loner a lot as a kid. I mean, I don't know. I really couldn't tell you. I've never gone into mm-hmm. deep analysis about that. It just is. And it's only recently in my life where I have gotten to the point where I'm like, no, I'm moving more into activism, because I use dialogue that's more about systemic oppression and racism and under, you know, pulling those policies apart that have continued this racism. And I went on a total soapbox even just yesterday about blood quantum and stuff in front of a group that I never would have done even a year ago. I would have, but I did.
I'm sorry, I missed what it was about.
Blood quantum. I was teaching a class on sovereignty at this conference in Las Vegas. And I had a whole group of people there from all tribes all over. And there's a controversy right now in tribal Indian country about tribes disenrolling, or what is an Indian, how much Indian are you? And a lot of it comes from this quantum mindset, you know, a quarter quantum. And many of our community don't know the history. They don't know the full story. And they don't know, have never been given the benefit to know that the reason it's a quantum is because it came at a time of allotment, and the federal government needed to figure out who the Indians were so that they would be entitled to land. But that was part of genocide, because in order to take that land, you became a United States citizen. You promised not to practice tribal. You wouldn't use your language, traditions. Your kids would go to school. You would go to church. You would farm. So the quantum is wrapped up completely with genocide. And they picked a fourth is because they thought within 2 to 3 generations we'd be gone because of all the intermingling. So quarter quantum is, the purpose behind it was always to wipe out the race of Native Americans on this continent. And it makes sense because they want our land, right? Whereas in the African American, one drop, you know, just one drop made you black. Well, they needed them to build the country, but control them. So, you know, just recognizing those, like even identifying what a race is wrapped up in racism. And so there is a lot of old school people in the community who think quantum is a tribal tradition because they don't know better. And so I kind of went off on a tangent about that issue because right now there's more constitutional reform in Indian country than ever before. And one of the most controversial topics is membership. How do we define who a member is? Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of it, people want to stick to this old, you know, how much Indian, how much blood do you have? And that's not traditional for any tribe. There's mm-hmm. no tribe I've ever found who can say prior to colonialization or prior to contact, they cared about blood. Mm-hmm. It was about community, sense of belonging, participation, knowing your language, your tradition, all of that. That's what being a member was, mm-hmm. not where does your blood come from? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I'm a little more, I pull in more language about oppression and racism than I ever have before.
And is that, why is that?
I think it's partly due to age. I'm 46 now. And so And I've been in a role now for a couple of years where I'm running things rather than representing or working with someone one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting farther away from the individual people.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think, you know, my participation in the Novo process, we've just done a lot of intensive work. And I'm with a group of they are activists. I'm the only service provider within this Move to End Violence, my cohort. Everyone else are either members of coalitions or, I mean, even if they do service, it's usually very limited to one kind of instance or one kind of issue, like youth empowerment.
Mm.
Whereas we're the only agency that does the multitude of things that we do,
mm-hmm.
because of the huge impact trauma has on so many different levels. So I'm meeting people who use this dialogue just naturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one... Anna's from Mexico. She lives in Chicago now, but she frequently will, you know, talk about essentially dismantling the patriarchal system. Hearing her talk about it is different than reading it. It absorbs for me better when I can hear it, ask questions and help me put it into a context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it is. I'm starting to see a shift. And then most recently, probably the biggest shift that happened is because I went to South Africa for 2 weeks, part of Novo as a learning exchange. And we spent a week in Cape Town and a week in Johannesburg. You know, we start with Robben Island. We ended with the Apartheid Museum. And we met people, all these NGOs in between. And we met one, Shirley Gunn, who, like, bombed buildings. You know, I mean, she's, like, hardcore, a white woman who... went and trained in Cuba to learn how to detonate and do that kind of, I mean, just hardcore. Anyway, while I was there, before I went, I remember apartheid. I was old enough. I remember it. I remember it on the news. I remember people talking about it. But I really equated it to the civil rights movement and based on race. I mean, or color. I should say color of skin because race is not accurate. There's no such thing as race, right? It's a created thing to justify continued slavery and stuff based on head size, right? I mean, that's a history of race. But while I was down there, I learned that the problems that the Africans were having were loss of language, loss of land, being removed and placed in these townships, the huge disparity between socioeconomic opportunity for the indigenous people of Africa versus the settlers. And I realized that, you know, this isn't about race at all. It has nothing to do with color. It is colonialism. This is the impact of colonialism. And it's the same here as it is back home. And for me, it was very profound of an experience because for many of my cohort, I felt like, except for the other two indigenous women, for everyone else, there seemed to be this kind of sense of really hope and positivity that this constitution has passed, and everyone has so much hope for that constitution. Everyone we spoke to spoke of it, and how they felt so empowered by the world's, you know, being allies with them and comrades, and you know the pressure from you know how grateful they were. And I. Went through the Apartheid Museum and to be honest, at one point I just broke away and just sat in the corner and sobbed. And someone else in our group did too. Whereas others were like empowered by this revolt and this, you know, like caught up in the revolution. And, you know, when we went around the circle the next day and kind of, you know, processed what we saw, you know, they came to me and I'm like, listen, you know, for me, this trip has been like life changing, but it's also been intensely depressing and sad because the same things that make you feel hopeful. I said, for me, as someone who sees the effect of colonialism and knows that we have a constitution that says all men, all people are created equal, I said, we're still waiting 500 years after contact. I said, it's very hard for me to believe it's going to be any different here, and that in 200 years from now, they're still going to be seeking equal treatment and equal opportunity, and we're going to be talking about inequities and disparities like we do here in Minnesota. Like, where are they coming from? Well, I can tell you where they come from. They come from systemic racism, oppression that's ingrained from a colonial experience, you know, but no one will talk about it. Mm. Prior to that experience, I didn't get it. I really, you know, there's almost all the languages, indigenous languages, have a word that it essentially equates to all my relatives. You may hear that. You may hear it out, you know, all my relatives. The concept never really hit home until I went to South Africa, that we really are all relatives, particularly the indigenous people, regardless of where we are on this planet. Mm. You know, that it's not just Lakota or Ojibwe or indigenous people of the United States or the First Nation. I mean, really, it's all of us have had the same experience from colonization. And no one talks about it. Right? You don't hear that from a government. That's for sure. Mm. Canada is getting better. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I hope I'm wrong. I hope South Africa does, like, open their eyes. But what I see on Facebook, no. You know, there's still huge gender inequalities and there's still violence happening against women, you know, despite the fact their constitution says everyone's equal. It's just now they don't mark boxes. They're not asked what their race is anymore, but they're still treated differently based on it. Right? Mm-hmm. It's now just harder to see because no one's paying attention. Mm-hmm. No one can point to documents because everyone's equal.
I want to go back to get us to, is it Novo, N-O-V-O?
Novo, yep. Okay. It is the Novo Foundation, the Move to End Violence.
Move, you're right.
Is what it is.
After you worked at the clinic and finished up college, then where did you go?
Let's see here. I graduated from ASU in 95, and then I moved back here.
Okay.
So I came to the Twin Cities.
And you went to law school then?
Nope, not right away. I started working at Health East, okay. Pediatricians for Help up in Maplewood, because of my healthcare background. Mm-hmm. I actually had planned, God help me, to go into forensic psychology, because mm-hmm. that's what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. but then I went to Manhattan for a visit, and I thought, I can't live here. There's no way I could live here for any extended period of time. There's no grass. It's just cement and noise. And
you were going to go there to study?
Yeah, to the John Jay School of Criminology. Mm-hmm. I had meetings with the FBI and recruiters. I mean, I thought I had my path passed, you know, lined up. But when I came back from that visit, I'm like, I can survive here. I mean, people walking dogs, they're like all crammed around this tiny little stick. You know, I'm like, how awful, these dogs have to pee on. I mean, I was just mortified. And I had a friend who was in law school at the time. And, you know, I'm having my, you know, existential crisis about what I'm going to do with my life now since dancing fell apart and now this fell apart. She's like, have you ever considered law? I'm like, huh, maybe that might be something. So I took the LSAT cold. I didn't even read the book. I went into the sucker totally cold. Went to law school aptitude test. I mean, right? I wanted to see if I had an aptitude. But I scored high enough that I got a full scholarship to Hamline. And I got some others, but that's where I wanted to go because it was small liberal arts. My friend had high recommendation for it. ASU was so huge. I really wanted something smaller. Mm-hmm. And I liked, yeah, that they had this public interest focus on what they did. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I went to Hamline. Uh-huh. Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved law school. I was one of those people. I loved it.
Why?
Because I actually formed relationships with the teachers. Like at ASU, there wasn't any. Here, I could actually have discussions with them. The other thing I like about law is it's not necessarily black or white. It's subject to interpretation, you know, but, you know, other areas use terminology that's not intuitive to the words that are being used. And those confuse me. Like, they make me very, like just recently I had someone explain to me what crabs in a bucket is or whatever. I had no idea what that meant. Because somebody's like, it's like crabs in a bucket. I'm like, what? What? Crabs in a bucket? What? And he's like, well, no, because, you know, if you put crabs in a bucket, they use each other to crawl up, but sooner or later, one gets almost to the top and someone will inadvertently pull them down. So it means, you know, when you're, you know, pretending to support each other, but in the end, you're just pulling each other down. I'm like, why don't you just say that? I mean, what? Makes no sense to me. Whereas law, I mean, you got your law, you got your precedent. I mean, it's all very logical and pragmatic. I love that about law. I love the pragmatic nature of law. And it's subject to interpretation. I mean, yeah, I like that too.
And so you were interested in the public interest piece of it. What did you know what you wanted to do?
No, not really. I thought maybe something in health, you know, because I'd done that for so long. That was my background. Never thought about Indian law or Indian child welfare. Never even considered that stuff. In fact, I did a summer associate position with Helen Lewis, Nyland, Sipkins, and Johnson at the time. They've broken up. I don't even know what they're called anymore. But they were a major healthcare. They represented health systems. And I thought, okay. And insurance defense and stuff of that. I did not get offered a position. And so I had to figure out what I was going to do, and I ended up clerking for a judge. And that judge was in juvenile court, and he did ICWA cases. And that's what really started why I'm here. That.
He did what?
Indian Child Welfare Act cases. He was one of the ICWA judges, which is a federal law that it's from 1978, but it does mandate like the placement of kids and higher standard for removal than non-Indian kids. More work has to be done to kind of fix the family before you can permanently terminate. But yeah, he Hennepin County has a large volume of the cases because there's such a high concentration of the community here. And so that's really where I started getting exposed. And also worth noting is I never marked the box in undergrad. I didn't mark the box till Hamline. So I really didn't even identify as a native person until I got to Hamline, and then I started to kind of rediscover that.
And what was behind that shift?
It's because when I was adopted, my father wanted to know, my adopted family wanted to know why there was a native child, because that is very unusual and weird to have a native child available in a private adoption. That there was no family, that no one would take them, because that's traditionally culturally appropriate. And the adoption agency actually told my parents that the tribe didn't want me because I was a half-breed. Since my mom was white, they did not want me. And so my parents, you know, I'm sure that there are two reasons why they chose to tell me that growing up. One, so I didn't set myself up for disappointment in case it was true. But I think part of it too was because my adopted mom was always extremely nervous that someone would take me. Like, I think there's always been in the back of her head an idea that they really never should have had me, that family, that I belonged with family, but they wanted me so bad, you know. So growing up, that she wouldn't take me to powwows, they didn't do anything because she was afraid someone would recognize me, essentially, or say, wait, why do you have her? And challenge them, and she didn't want to be challenged. Now, what's ironic about it is my dad, on the flip side, I think if he hadn't believed that is true, like it never occurred to him that they would lie, which they did. I mean, I learned that when I met the adoption agency. That wasn't true. My grandma wanted me desperately, and she was 40 when I was born, so she would have been young enough, and there was other family, there was extended family, so yeah. But at that time in 1970, and for many years after, adoptions were only considered successful if you severed the ties of all family so that the child could grow roots in this new one. The problem with that, though, is if my dad had known who the family was or who the tribe was, he would have reached out and tried to find family to grow the family. Not to give me away, but so that I could have probably gone home on the summers, like gotten to know him, learned language, you know, because he saw that as important. But he had no reason not to believe them. And so he may not have agreed with it. But I think when he chose to tell me that, it's because he was afraid I would go looking and be rejected, and that that would be even worse. Mm-hmm. So I, yeah, grew up, you know, knowing I was Native, but not really identifying as such. I never felt a part of their tribe, because I'm not Osage either. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then and thinking that they didn't want me anyway, so fine, I don't, if you don't want me, I don't want you. It really wasn't until Hamlin, I got involved in the Native American Law Student Society, and I started meeting a couple of other of the Native students. I marked the box, right, though my score, but there again, instantly, I have to justify that I got a full scholarship. Like if you know I'm Native and I say I got a scholarship, oh, because you're Indian. Well, no, actually, my score was high enough that I would have gotten it anyway. But yeah, that you instantly, you know, outside was single story me into, oh, it's because you marked the box, right? You know, they have to defend it. Yeah, no, I totally lost my train of thought. Oh, and then when I started doing the ICWU cases with the judge, it's when I started meeting people from various tribes and learning that this idea that the tribe wouldn't want me was completely foreign and wrong. I mean, that there was no basis in that in anyone I'd ever met. In fact, it's the complete flip off opposite. The tribes were fighting tooth and nail to keep the kids within the tribe, even if it's not with the family, you know, or the biological parents, to just keep them within the community. That's what everybody was fighting for. And so that's when, yeah. And yeah, I asked my grandma. She was like, no, she tried to find my mom, but by the time she found her, she'd come back from the... Because my biological mom was shipped to Fargo to an unwed mother's home. She had no idea where she was in the world. I told her she gave birth in Fargo because they picked them up in the middle of the night. They had no idea whether they were driving north, south, east, west. And they took them back in the middle of the night after they gave birth. They weren't allowed to leave the house ever. Yeah, I mean, isn't that insane? It's just insane. So when she came back, she wasn't pregnant. And she couldn't even tell my grandma where she'd given birth. She could have been in South Dakota. She could have been in Montana. She could have been in Iowa. I mean, she had no idea.
So when did you find all that out?
I found out, I think, let's see... 4 years ago is when I met my mom, met my biological mom. I finally, mostly because of my kids, I thought I really need to find out where I'm from. I knew I was Sioux, that's all they would say, but it was important to me to know where I was from. Mm-hmm. And so I called the adoption agency, right? And they looked and found and connected.
That's powerful. Okay, so you discover the ICWU cases, and that sets you on a new path?
Absolutely, totally new path.
So what happened then?
Well, I clerked for the judge for several years until he decided to go up to grown-up court. We joke about both my kids, I had them while I worked for the judge.
Okay.
So I didn't have any leave. I mean, with Jerry, my oldest, I had 2 weeks off after the time I gave birth to when I went back. But the judge was... very flexible, and so even though he was paying me full time, I really was only in the office part time and then doing stuff at home. And then for Gabe, I managed to save up a month of PTO, so I got to stay home for twice as long with him. But yeah, when he went to the grown-up court, I had a moment of not sure what again, have another life crisis, right? Of what do I want to do? And I kind of thought, well, maybe health, maybe I should try going back to health. Maybe I should try to do the money, essentially. Maybe I should try to use my law degree to get money and be money focused in my career. And so for a year and a half, I did executive compensation and benefit analysis for nonprofit health systems. I've never been so miserable in my life. It was the worst job ever. Even though they paid me a lot, benefits were great, right? On-site health. I mean, it was just insane. But I would walk to work every day. I hate my job. I hate my job. And when I'd turn around and leave, I was dreading that I had to come back in a day. I mean, I was so unhappy. And maybe if I'd gone there right after law school, I would have never seen, like, court, like, seen the families, like, had that experience. But... the shift between these families who are struggling with all this stuff and still doing a remarkable job, and CEOs bitching because they don't get use of the corporate jet without claiming it as a benefit, you know, and winning these golden punt or parachutes, even if they're fired. I mean, it's too much. And so the Equal Law Center, which is still in town, called me out of the blue and said, listen, would you consider working for us? One of our attorneys is going JAG. She's an opportunity to go back into the military law JAG. She was in the reserve. But she's going to be leaving in a week. And it took me like a sec. I mean, there was no doubt. But I did have to talk to my husband because it was a cut of salary of 40%. And I lost all my benefits, right? So my husband had to, he's a cop. He had to pick up, be willing to pick up more off duty to make everything equal. And he too was instantly like, oh, of course. So I gave 1 week notice. I mean, I dropped projects. I did the most unethical, like in my mind, unprofessional, but I was so glad to be out of there. And then I worked for the Law Center for almost 4 years.
Doing as an attorney.
Direct representation of families involved in child protection. Indian families involved in child protection in state court and tribal courts. So White Earth, Leech Lake, I was licensed in Mille Lacs. Boys Fort. And then statewide, but mostly Hennepin County, because this is where the bulk of the urban population is.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I loved it. It was a great job. Oh my God, I love that job.
Why?
Because I really felt like I was helping people, like I was an activist, you know, for a family. I was an advocate, a strong advocate. And man, I rock in court. I just do. Because I can be the reasonable one no matter what. I mean, and I think because I'm so pragmatic and I'm so like just, it is what it is, people's situations didn't impact me at an emotional level like others may have. So, you know, the fact that a mom, you know, had been house jumping or living out of her car or, you know, was prostituting herself to make ends meet, I had no emotional response to it, no judgment. It is what it is. But I could frame it in a way in court to be sympathetic or to be just matter of fact. I mean, what else do you want her to do? And I was good at that. I wasn't good at prepping for trial books. That's way too much. Like, look at my office, like organizing and detailing stuff out. And I just, no. Most of the time we didn't go to trial anyway because they either not show or they just admit anyway. But I finally, I just had one case happen and it just, I was already getting tired, but this case made me kind of think that it's futile. I mean, the futility of the child protection system and how totally dysfunctional and messed up it is. I don't know if it is that way everywhere, but it certainly is in Minnesota. And I just decided not to do
what,
it anymore.
What had happened?
Well, because I'd worked with the judge for several years and then started representing clients, you know, that was a span of 3, 4 and a half, you know, like 7, 8 years. So I had situations where I would end up with a child as a parent of a parent that we had in court when I was clerking. So with the judge as his law clerk, we terminated parental rights on somebody. That kid ended up going into foster care, and when she ages out pregnant, child protection opens automatically on them. They don't even give them a chance. So, and that happened more than once, right? Or they came back, you know. So we had them in court and then they came back and I'm now representing them as their attorney, you know, 3 years later because things haven't gotten much better. But this was a case where we did terminate the mom and she had two older kids, a girl and a boy. The girl, I want to say, was probably about 14, 15 at the time, and her brother was a couple years younger. He went to grandmother's. So their grandmother, the maternal grandmother, was able to take custody of him, but couldn't take the girl. Didn't have enough space. The county wouldn't support it because her apartment was too small, right? But they won't give her money to get a bigger one, God forbid. So the girl went into foster care. And she did end up pregnant and did age out. And so she's 18 now, has a baby. The county took the kid at birth. No positive drug tests, no whatever. And their rationale was basically because of her behavior in foster care, which was directly attributed to the fact that she was in foster care, right? I mean, she ran. She's trying to go home and see family, and they wouldn't let her. You know, she's staying out late because her foster parents were terrible. You know, I mean, it's just annoying. But that's not what did it, because that's common. But the baby, because it needed to go into foster care, we tried to argue to put the baby with grandma. Because the brother, by that point, was no longer living at home. Nobody knew where he was. He was 16, heavily involved in drugs and gangs, had like hardcore felony, you know, adult level stuff on his record by now. That, you know, some of which came with him when he moved in with her. I mean, he got it while he was in foster care, but whatever. Because under licensing, it doesn't matter if they live there or not, but he is legally hers. She was unlicensable because of his criminal record, even though everyone admitted he hadn't been living home for 2 years. So kid goes into non-family, stranger foster home. So we fast forward a few months, and this was like in the fall. Fast forward a few months. Every court hearing we have, I'm arguing for the kid to go home. It's not happening. My client is showing up with her mother, who we terminated when I worked for the judge, and her grandmother. You know, I mean, three generations of women. I mean, despite all of this involvement, are still together. Nothing changed that. And then her summer comes, or late spring, and the brother is shot in a drive-by shooting. He was the first murder of the season in Minneapolis. And the very next day, the baby was placed with grandma because the licensing barrier was dead. And, you know, I sat there, and I'm going to cry because it's, you know, I thought millions of dollars have been spent on this family to keep them apart, essentially. That's been the entire focus, that no one ever thought about what really is best for these kids, which would have probably been together with grandma with support. But instead, they've created now four generations of dysfunction because the baby's already in foster care. The chances of it going home are unlikely. And why? What are we doing here? What are we doing? You know, that child, the son, was struggling because of foster care, because they took him away from his family. But it's his fault. You know, it was the mother's fault until they terminated. Then it was his fault because he wouldn't behave. And it was my client's fault because she kept running away. I mean, but really at the core of all of it was just this deep desire to be together that the system would not respect. And yeah, I started looking hardcore after that case. I just could not do it anymore. Because they're all like that. They're all. And it still is bad. It still is bad. So I wanted to try to get into a role where I was preventing it. Just trying to prevent it. And so then I moved into, I got in a job with the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin. And it was a contract position through a federal grant that funneled through the state. And they passed the Wisconsin Indian Child Welfare Act, which was codifying the federal law into their state law. And then I was responsible for the implementation. So developing curriculum, training materials, tangible, like, you know, guides, and then training everyone in the state. So
To
follow the law and to understand why it's necessary, which is what I saw my role as. Anybody can read law, but to understand why something like the Indian Child Welfare Act or why the Wisconsin Indian, why do Indian children, why should they get extra, which is what people think? Why shouldn't they just be like other children? Why are we treating them differently? Well, because the experience, because of colonization, because the experience has been different for Indian children, and the attempts to tear families apart have been going on for forever. So it's not a surprise that our families right now are experiencing such high level mental health, chemical health, dysfunction, homelessness, every measurable bad thing that we're at the top of the list on, you know, because we're less than one generation away from forced sterilization of our women in hospitals, you know, of child welfare suites where they would just show up with black cars and grab kids, you know, in the 50s and 60s. I mean, why are we surprised when no one has done anything to deal with the trauma? Like, what multi-generational intense trauma does to a community? You know, you can't just shake that shit off and pull your boots up and act like nothing ever happened. Mm-hmm. It's in our DNA at this point, right? I mean, that's been proven now. That we could have told you that years ago, but yeah, the pact of the parent creates a cellular genetic change that you can see now in the kids. Yeah, duh. We could have told, yeah, our elders have been telling us that for generations. Mm-hmm. But sorry, I got a little soapboxy there.
That's all right. So did you find working on that in Wisconsin, did that satisfy the desire to...
Yeah, it helped a lot because we saw impact. Mm. That the out-of-home placements started to go down. And it was because of, I think, direct effect of that training and to understand the history and the context and the why and the how, so that people were approaching families from a more empathetic, full understanding rather than a judgmental, short-term kind of assessment. Because, I only had a couple of instances where I just ran into pure racism, right? Where they were just didn't like Indians. Most people, they didn't understand the history. They had no idea. And having that explained so they could understand had an impact on the way they did their job. So it was a great experience. I would have probably, I didn't stay to the bitter end, because I got headhunted. I got recruited to work at DIW as their executive director.
What's DIW?
Division of Indian Work. Oh. They're in town here. They're on Lake. They're part of the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches. Mm-hmm. So they're not their own 501c3. Mm-hmm. They're just the largest program of the GMCC.
And what do they do?
They started 60 plus years ago as a food shelf during urban relocation when so many Native families were pushed into the urban settings, but Minneapolis wasn't a targeted center. Chicago was, so there weren't any resources here. And so, yeah, church people, reached down to help those people and started a food shelf. And then so now they have a lot of youth kind of work, after school programs, math programs. I'm not sure if they still have the program, but they had a staff member who actually served in the school to be kind of a liaison between the school and the parents and the kids, as far as catching excessive absences earlier. What else do they do? Or what did we do? Oh, when I was there, we had two group homes, one for foster care boys and one for foster care girls. But I know the boy one still continues, but they closed the girl one after I left. And last I heard, they were renting it to a former employee just as housing.
And you came here from there?
I did.
So tell me what the Resource Center does.
We are focused on healing whatever needs to be healed. So we have a multitude of services. We have been in this space now. It'll be 25 years in November. But we've been around for 31. It was started by three Native women and a man. So I was like, man. For a while there, he was taken out of the narrative, which I found disturbing. We put him back in. Because we need both. We need both energies for success. But the oldest program is our training. They open the center to help educate service providers who are working with Native communities to better understand the history, communication differences, culture, stuff like that. And so the Learning Center is our longest program. We have that, and there's a library. People aren't as interested anymore because you can get stuff on the internet. But it used to be we were a high source because we have some books and documents you can't get anywhere else that have to do with Native, the tribes here in Minnesota. As well as Minnesota authors and stuff. So that's on site here. Again, it's behind the receptionist, actually. Then what we also do, we have Nokomis and Dodd, which is Grandmother's House in Ojibwe. And that is a co-occurring CD program. So all of our clients have both a diagnosis of mental health issues, whether it's a chronic one or a situational. And they have a chemical dependency problem. And then what that program does is it's the only gender specific, because it's only women, culturally appropriate dual diagnosis program in this federal region. Unfortunately, it's not inpatient. It's not, there's no residency component to it. And at any given moment, up to 80% of those women are homeless. That's crazy. But they stay sober, right? They come in and do our programming. It's also a three-tiered 18-month program, so it's a longer extended. But they utilize an elder in residence. So Donna's there. So they do sweats. They do, they'll go out ricing. They'll go out and gather sumac. They just integrate culture. Because the other thing I think our agency does beautifully is we recognize the power and strength of blood memory. So even if I have clients who have not been raised traditionally, have never gone to the reservation, their families don't even really know where they're from or how to follow, when we start integrating ceremony and medicines, traditional medicines like sage, cedar, sweetgrass, tobacco, it connects to them at a cellular level, and that helps programming stick in a way. So the other stuff can work. We also do a lot of mind-body medicine work. So both of my elders are certified out of the Center for Mind-Body Medicine out of San Francisco and DC, I think are the two places. And they integrate those kind of integrated health modality kind of work in with culture and tradition. Because most of the things that these mind-body medicine groups do are actually historically traditional medicines and techniques that have been used by indigenous people forever, right? But now it's wrapped up in a nice little program and, you know, everyone else wants to do it. So, but we are doing it very, very effectively. So that's Nokomis and Dot. It's the only gender-specific programming we have. And that's because of our licensing. We have our family stabilization work, which is child protection. We try to prevent it through parenting classes, life skill, one-on-one case management. In-home parenting is what we're doing a lot now because our clients are struggling so intensely with mental health issues, they can't even function in a group. So our staff go out to their homes. We also have an ICWA position. So Marie goes to court, gets assigned cases that go live or go open, and then she helps them manage services and case management and tries to kind of be that liaison to help explain. So she'll go to court with them and to assist to explain all that, because it can be very confusing and complicated. Plus, I know from representing most families who are involved in child protection, we all know someone who was involved and we never saw their kids again. So there's really a strong misconception in a lot of ways, but it's just perceived that if child protection gets involved, you lose your kids. And that child protection gets involved earlier and more intensely with Native families, which, I mean, if you look at Minnesota, our disparity of out-of-home placement for Native kids versus non-Native, if you equalize it by population, we are the worst state in the nation, and we are fast approaching pre-ICWA levels of the 70s. So there's a huge disparity in the out-of-home placement of Indian kids. But no one seems to really want to acknowledge the why, and it's really kind of the systemic racism, the past trauma, as well as a lack of any housing, affordable housing, living wage, that kind of stuff. So that's family stabilization. Then we have our Healing Journey program, Sacred Journey. Sacred Journey is like the second oldest program, or Healing Journey. These are for our women 21 and older, and it's a support group twice a week. They do culture, tradition, but they also do curriculum on, life skills. A lot of them, particularly if they've lived on the street quite a bit, you know, don't know how to shop, grocery shop, or how to manage a budget, or how to manage a house. And so they learn skills like that in there. Plus, it's not a dry program. They just cannot be high when they come. However, the vast majority stay sober and keep sober throughout the time they're coming, even though there's no CD quality or component to that program. It's just the reasons why they're drinking or using, we're identifying and filling. So those ladies make beautiful quilts. I mean, that dream catcher was made by the ladies down there. I mean, they're constantly doing stuff. They're just amazing. Love them. There'll be an article in the Star Trib about them pretty soon, because we've had a reporter following them around for quite some time. Then we have our Oshkenije Kwe, Oshkenije 1 and 2. And Oshkoshkadad. And this is for women or girls really under 21. And Safe Harbor. We have two positions funded through Safe Harbor. So this is a risk reduction, harm reduction program for trafficking to either work with victims or suspected victims or to work with kids who are at very high risk, which is all of them. I mean, if you're Native and a youth, you're high risk because the numbers there too are hugely disparate. Disparate numbers. In 2013, I know one of the Minneapolis cops who does trafficking said 75% of his cases involve Native American kids, mm-hmm. and we're less than 2% of the population. Mm-hmm. So huge, hugely overrepresented. So we do a lot of work there. And then Safe Harbor, we have two positions funded through that, one through Direct Services and the other one is a tribal Safe Harbor. And Minnesota, a couple years back, passed the law that makes under 18, you can't convict someone for prostitution. It directs them towards services instead. Mm-hmm. And so we've been trying to kind of work up the bugs of how that system is really going to work. But funding came along with it. So we have a couple of positions funded through that work.
When did you say that was passed?
Oh, when was Safe Harbor? 2010,
okay. Maybe?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, look it up. I know it was before I started here. Suzanne, my predecessor, was heavily involved with all of that. Mm-hmm. And it has been around now for a few years. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the legal changes that Minnesota has been making, and I've been talking to some of the other people I interviewed about the Women's Economic Security Act.
Mm-hmm.
Was this organization involved in that at all?
We have a serious problem, and actually a couple weeks ago, myself and several other leaders from nonprofits here in town had a meeting with the governor's chief of staff and various commissioners. Because in Minnesota, part of the problems with the disparities in equity is the fact that the governor and the commissioners don't appear to recognize that it's not white and other. And in almost every instance, they leave the Native American community out. And even by their own recordings, reporting, TV, newspaper, they're saying they're doubling down, they're, you know, focusing this money, they've created this whole new position because of disparities so bad, and then they say, so we're going to, you know, impact the African-American community. Well, nothing about the Native American, nothing about the Asian American, I mean, or even anything about the New American, because, you know, the Somali community that has come here have a completely different set of needs than the African American community who are based in slavery as a past and have been here for, you know. But again, it's that's to me a systemic racism. They really only see color, like black is black, and not seeing the uniqueness and kind of differences within that, and then assuming that whatever they do to help the black community will help the red community, which will help the yellow, which, you know, I mean, it's crazy. But yeah, nothing came out as far as what they're going to do to address disparities in the Native American community, despite the fact we out disparate the African American in almost every measurable category. We are killed more often by the police. We are overrepresented in prison at a higher level based on population. We have more homeless. We have 51% unemployment. I mean, 51% of employable people in Minnesota are unemployed, you know, way higher. You know, if you take the extreme out, you know, like Prairie Island and Shakopee, which have very high per capita, if you take that out, our annual income way lower than the African American, you know, but no one talks about it. Or they talk about it in a way that pits us against each other, which is ridiculous.
So who's that? When you say they,
the government, the anytime they do an RFP, anytime they talk to the media about disparities, they don't acknowledge or recognize the differences that are within. And right now, if you Google it, all they say is African American. We're going to impact the African American disparities. We're going to, you know, increase business, do whatever with the African American. So, yeah, frequently If we get invited to the table, it's at the last minute. It's was an oops, we forgot to invite the Indians. Mm-hmm. It's not with any kind of intentionality or authentic desire to really consult. And that's what we brought forth to the governor's, you know, office is, listen, we know what we need to do. All you have to do is ask us, instead of this top-down, we're going to fix you, or we're going to use this model from the north side that's worked beautifully with the African-American community. Well, that's a different community. Just because it works there, it's unlikely, quite frankly, that it will work here. And without asking us to, that's another thing, they'll just drop stuff on. I mean, without asking the residents of Little Earth, do you really want... For instance, I'll give you a concrete example. Up in the north side, which is predominantly African-American, they have followed up with domestic violence now, where the day after, a social worker and a cop will show up again to meet with them, family, to see how it's going, to talk to them about services, to see if they are knowledgeable and, you know resources they can reach out to get support and help. They have questions about orders for protection, restraining, you know, all of that. They're there to do this. And it's successful. Kind of, you know, as data's always skewed, but it has had some success. So the city has kind of decided, you know what, that went so well, let's do it in Little Earth, which is, you know, the highest, it's the largest housing development for Native Americans in the nation. Huge volume. People have lived there for generations. It's been around for a long time. But they never, ever asked Little Earth how they would feel. And I can tell you, without a doubt, that if a cop shows up the next day with a social worker, a non-Native cop, there aren't that many, no one's going to talk to them. I mean, they're going to think they're there to take their kids, because domestic violence is grounds to remove your children. And they do it all the time in the Native community. So they're not going to talk to you. But yeah, they're going to invest money into doing this because they want to help us, right? And that was kind of the pushback, as well. We didn't think it would work in the north side either. And it's been successful. Okay, lucky you. It's not gonna be successful here. It's not. Mm. Good luck, but no. But yeah, this kind of, we're invisible. We are invisible. Mm. To systems, to media, to classrooms, to the government. We are invisible and have been for a long time.
So your focus, the anger is focused on the government, the governor. I guess my question is, some of the other women I've talked to have a lot of anger at what they see as the white women's movement. Mm. So around the WESA, the Women's Economic Security Act, there was, you know, lobbying and organizing and stuff that was done by the Minnesota Women's Consortium and other groups convened by the Women's mm-hmm. Consortium. Were there Native women involved in...
I have to look at the list. I was certainly not invited.
Yeah.
You know.
But you don't...
I don't, and even when I say I'm angry at the governor, I think it comes from ignorance. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, you know, I joke that I picture that there's this, like, group of white men somewhere that just laugh and point mm-hmm. at how successful they've been at creating an environment where we think we have to fight each other for scarcity when there is no scarcity, that they pit us against each other so that it's Black Lives Matter, Native Lives Matter, you know, or even internally within our own agencies. You know, there wasn't that long ago that, you know, OIC, Indian Center, MIWRC, and Little Earth, even though we're like right here within blocks of each other, we're not collaborative, won't cooperate, we're competing for funding, wouldn't tell each other, which completely defeats the purpose of serving the community. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm glad we're not that way now, but it wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's ignorance. You know, it's not an intentional thing. I don't think anyone is intentionally racist, right? But I think the system as a whole is, because it's historically been... I mean, the Capitol is sitting on stolen land, right? It is filled with artwork that is offensive, wrong and just inaccurate, you know, as history. They are only now, even rarely will they bring up the fact that there are indigenous people here, or they'll say the Dakota and the Ojibwe. Okay. Historically, yes, this was land of the Ojibwe in the north and Dakota in the bottom. But now there are tribes from all over, people who live in the state, are residents of the state, and you're not even counting them because they're not one of those two tribes. Okay, you're making an entire race of people invisible unless they fit your definition of what's an Indian, which is wrapped up in racism anyway, even if they don't realize it, right? So, you know, I think the Native experience is a little different from some of the other communities of color, is because for many of us, we are at the point now where we'd rather fix ourselves and have support in doing that, and everyone else just stay away. You've done nothing but damage for hundreds of years now. Go away. And I think for some, you know, that's puts them off a bit too, right? You know, because I think there's so many well-meaning people in the world. They just aren't educated, are ignorant to kind of the reality of stuff. They want a single story, you know, entire groups of people in a way that serves them, like may get numbers on a chart to look like there's movement, but really hasn't done anything. You know, we joke, Minnesota wins all these things about the best state for this and this. It's like, in parentheses, if you're white. I mean, because they take out the bad data that, you know, oh, and it has the highest out of placement rates for children of color, you know. Has the most bicycle paths, yes, and it has the most children of color who don't graduate from high school, who drop out. You know, it's a great state to live within if you're white. White, and you have at least $65,000 a year or more if you want to live in the city, because they just published that. So if you live under that and you're a person of color, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we started recording, we were starting to talk about the concept of a lot of what you talked about that the Resource Center does is for women and their families. And you were starting to talk to me about the concept of feminism, how that would or wouldn't be recognized in the community. Mm. Can you tell me about that? Is that a concept or a word that's used here?
I think in some of the younger groups, feminism is a word that may come up more often. Mm. It's never been a word I've heard in my entire academic professional life up until fairly recently, right? When it kind of bubbled up to the surface again, and more. And what was interesting to me is even when I'd see it bubble up, it was still more of a negative. I mean, it was more like calling out people who say they're feminist and pointing out how they're not. And I despise that kind of stuff. I disengage from it.
Where were you seeing that?
You know, on social media, in articles, on TV, and the news reports, you know, usually some, what was the one I thought I saw fairly recently? What's her name? Some young, like, musician person called herself a feminist. And people were all over her, like, on why she wasn't or why she didn't understand it, you know? And it just... it's such a negative way to look at life. I mean, and I just don't play that game. I just don't do it. And so it seems to me that, yeah, most of the times I hear about feminism, it's either in the context of pointing out how someone is not a real, like, you're not really a feminist because of whatever. Or I've seen a few things recently, and mostly because of my Move to Inviolence, because Jamia Wilson does a lot of work here, is feminism in a digital, like with online bullying, and you know, that women experience far more of that, because she does blogs, and she's just very, she used to work for TED Talks, you know, and how to legislate that to, like, how do we get anti-bullying, mm-hmm. cyberbullying kind of stuff? And but it's never been really in the framework of my thought process.
So what is the Move to End Violence?
Move to End Violence is, remember a few years ago when Warren Buffett gave his kids each, what was it, $1 billion to start philanthropy, to do good. This is Peter's money. Mm-hmm. So Peter and his wife Jennifer spent several years actually researching what could they really do to have an impact instead of just offering grants. And we like education, you know. I mean, it was a very well thought out, investigated. They brought in experts. They did roundtables. I mean, they really did think. I have a lot of respect. I've met with them, and I was like, okay, you guys are, like, legit. And what they came up with is that in order to do true change in violence, you can't just give short-term kind of grants to address services, because that's not going to change the problem. What they needed to do and what they are doing is invest in a long-term commitment of essentially what they call building movement makers. And so they have 5 cohorts every other year. I'm in the third. I'm right in the middle. The first kind of defined what the focus would be and kind of the ground rules. The second, well, one of the shootings happened during their convening, and the Black Lives Matter movement kind of exploded within their cohort. So that kind of became their focus of how they could support that. We came in and we're kind of the bridge. Then there's going to be 2 more cohorts. And the idea is building these intense partnerships between each other so that we can move forward more movement making, more transformative thought, changing policy by changing the way people approach problems. And it really, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what, because the people they've selected, they've also been very deliberate in the type of people they're picking for the movement. And yeah, that's why I went to South Africa. It was part of our learning exchange. Mm-hmm. So it's very intensive networking, but also doing strategic planning and, you know, having funds so that next week, of course, I can't go. I'm going to have to call them, and they're going to be probably mad at me because I have to do legislative stuff. But, you know, strategic, transformative, forward-thinking mm-hmm. kind of workshop.
So it's violence broadly defined. It's not violence against women. Or...
For them, it is women and children, mm-hmm. but they've also been open to the idea that most of us do not see it as just women and children, mm-hmm. Particularly like with the Two-Spirit work we do. I was clear when I applied too that, you know, when you say women and children, I include any self-identifying person who considers themselves a female. Mm-hmm. Entity of some sort, even if they consider themselves as they, you know, that I don't see violence as solely a gender issue, because I can empower women and children. I mean, I can, though children, they're boys in there too, right? I can empower a woman, like say she's in an abusive relationship. I can give her all the programming, empower her, get her to see what a healthy relationship, whatever. She may leave him, but there's another one that takes her place. And I've done nothing to end violence against women and children. I'm still only saving them one at a time. So this, to me, that gender focus on ending violence is part of the problem. Because the men, at least in my community, and that's all I can speak to, also come from the same traumas that the women have. You know, from the boarding schools, the sexual, the mental, the, you know, the physical abuse, the trauma of not being able to be a man for your family too, as child protection is taking away, or your kids are going to boarding school, or your, you know, women are being attacked. I mean, I can't imagine the impacts. I'm not a man, but it's not a gender issue. It's a person, you know, it's a trauma issue. We have to address the trauma. Not that I'm saying there aren't some just evil people in the world, but I don't think there are that many. Mm. And they're, and I, you know, it still interests me. Some of the old school, even in the cohorts, still have that kind of men bad mentality. You know, let's, you know, we're going to empower women so we don't need men anymore. But I just, no matter what, I can't embrace, I just can't embrace that thought process. And I've been obvious, they picked me anyway, right? I'm kind of the voice of pragmatism, even in many of our meetings, right?
Sometimes, tell me about two-spirit work, what does that mean?
Oh, LGBTQ.
Okay.
Yeah, so in many of the, well, some of them don't call it two-spirit, which is why we do LGBT. You know, if you're down in the Southwest, like the Dene, two-spirit means you're crazy, right? So you have to make sure you're clear. But, you know, like in Lakota and Sioux, just all of them, the idea is that if an individual, a male, is born with female qualities, that's actually a blessing. They're a better person for it. And historically, prior to colonization, they were seen as, you know, high men, like elders or teachers or wise men or women, you know. And to be married to one was, like, beyond awesome. You know, then Christianity came in with colonial people, and that shifted. And so we're really trying to return the discussion back to traditional ways of thinking of it and respecting and honoring the family and however they identify. We don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So we do, on Saturdays, we do groups now. And we just did we're starting an art show. It's starting tomorrow. And we'll have an all-day event, education kind of community event with a gallery thing, you know, reception in the evening, honoring our two-spirit community members.
Mm-hmm. So if the younger women maybe hear or use the word feminism, and the older women maybe don't, but is there a... a different sense of, I don't know, women's empowerment or women, like, is that a, there are, you know, I've seen some places where, let's say in, I was talking to someone about some place in the Middle East, and she was like, you know, we don't use the term feminism, but there's a very strong sense of women's
equality. Yeah. Exactly.
Is that, would that...
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, the word equality sometimes I think is a struggle too, because there isn't equality between genders anyway, just by virtue of nature.
Mm-hmm. So right? There's difference.
There is difference. Mm-hmm. You know, men are traditionally stronger because they have more dense, you know, I mean, there's a science to the differences too. So I think sometimes there's pushback even in the community of that saying that we're equal is right off, is a lie from the beginning. I mean, but it's more about respect, you know. Are women respected, and are they held, you know, at a position of equal authority, equal decision making, equal competence as men? And then I would say yes, even knowing that in the community there are some tribes of very defined roles for female and male, right? Some, you know, the women are the caregivers, the men are maybe more the leaders, but there's a... You know, I found it interesting when we were, like, prepping to go to South Africa, you know, we had to do this kind of cultural competence because they wanted to make sure that, you know, the privileged Americans didn't go to South Africa and make asses of ourselves, right? And one of the questions was, you're meeting with an NGO, there's women there, and the man does all the talking, and even when you try to engage with the women, you know, the men intervene. You know, and then we had dialogue about it, and some were like, well, you know, that would be really hard. I'd wonder, are they being abused? You know, and what's funny is those, I mean, this patriarchy never hit my, I mean, it wasn't even my radar. For me, I was thinking, well, chances are this may be a community where the men do all the talking because that's their role, but I have no doubt that when they go home, the women will either chew them out for saying the wrong thing, or, you know, that you shouldn't presume automatically some kind of patriarchal system just because the man is speaking and the woman is not. Maybe she doesn't want to. I mean, that too. I mean, that is equality as well. Maybe I choose not to take on that role. That's equality too, because I had a choice. So defining it more from, yeah, how are they viewed? What are their choices? Do they have choices? Rather than, am I unequal? I mean, I don't want to be unequal with men. I don't. But I do want to be respected. I do want my decisions to be heard, listened to, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel that I'm not, you know, like out in the community, I've never felt anything but respect and mutual, you know, reaching out even for advice from other men in the community, right? Mm-hmm. But I did, I will share one in I'll share a story with you, which I still, I'm like, oh my God. So when I first took this role, I was interim. And so there was a whole process of screening, of course, that another woman applied, or others, and then they got it down to the two of us, and then they selected me. And I served on the board, too. I've known this agency a long time. So one of the board members, who I at the time considered a very good friend, have since learned not so much. Of things she's been doing kind of behind the scenes, but we met because she said, listen, I really need to meet with you and talk to you, you know, I want to kind of fill you in on things and let you know. So we went and had coffee and having a great conversation. Like I said, I thought she was a good friend, and then she's like, well, okay, I need to bring something up, it's really uncomfortable and I don't want you to be upset, but I just feel like I need to. I was like, all right. Now she's about 10 years older than me too, so this is a woman in her 50s, mid-50s, and she's like, well, I'm just going to say it. She's like, you know, Patina, you need to tone all this down because you're a beautiful woman and no one's going to take you serious because of that. And I remember like that, probably like the same looks going through my face of, what did she just say? Okay, thank you for the compliment. I couldn't even process it. I mean, I had to go home and think about it. Other than I said, thank you. You know, I'm glad you felt that you could be upfront about that. But I thought, wow. I mean, and this is a woman who I would say, if you asked her, are you a feminist? She would say yes. She's adamant about kind of this outward appearance of, you know, she quit her job at the state because men were getting promoted over her. And, you know, she was, and I'm thinking, you know... Wow, are you really? I mean, because to me, a true feminist would never have said that to me or even assumed it. And she's wrong. I've never had anyone treat me other than like I'm competent because I've proven myself competent despite of how I look, you know? I did not tone this down, you know? But yeah, it's just crazy, crazy.
Mm-hmm. So... Is your
No, that's all right. My clock up there says 5 to 1. Because oh. I need a battery. So I was just, yeah.
Is this program a, like a member of the Minnesota Women's Consortium?
I'm not sure if we are or not, actually. It's interesting. I was just on a call when I was in Vegas. I called in, and there's been discussion on coalitions. How can coalitions reach out better to communities of color and to coalitions of color? And my advice to them on the call was, well, I'm not in a coalition, so you're maybe not to me yet. I think you need to work that out amongst yourselves. Oops, yeah. Because... vacuuming Friday night, because if you're going to include service providers in this, that's a whole nother spectrum of stuff. You might want to keep it to coalition, but until I'd sat in that call, because I just don't get involved much with coalitions. I didn't realize that dynamic was going on. Mm-hmm. And the two or three people on the call that were from native based coalitions, consortiums, whatever, felt that intensely, did feel that they were excluded from kind of national, you know, and weren't sure why or how that had happened. Or I think it's just, we're invisible. I mean, in all areas, right? It's just, we're not thought of even. So I don't think it's intentional. I don't read, and maybe that's my flaw. I'd never read intentionality into anything, but I do think that just because of this lack of awareness of Native Americans as a living and breathing thing and not just a historic, that more mainstream or even other communities of color that have coalitions
don't think of us because they have no context to put us into. You know, everything they learn is, you know, made up pilgrim stories and made up, you know, treks across the United States. You know, I mean, it's just, I think it's all a carryover from that kind of mentality.
Is there a network, like I was talking to, or emailing with Nevada Little Wolf, do you know her?
That name is very familiar.
She's started something called Rural American Indian Leadership, something, RAIL, up in, I think, Virginia, Minnesota?
Ah, yeah, up on the Iron Range. Mm-hmm. That's probably why her name sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's just interesting because I am, we're a service provider. It is interesting. We tend to be kept out of the coalition work too. Because it seems to me that, yeah, coalitions are more focused on policy and training, kind of awareness raising or campaign kind of things. And I'm busy serving people, everyone who walks in the door, housing, mental health, chemical health. You know, what is that problem? We're addressing it at the ground level. And sometimes I've also realized as I'm doing this longer and be more well, because the other problem, I'm not very self-aware of stuff that is going out in the periphery unless I'm targeted on it. I don't know if that's the Asperger or this defense. I don't know. But if it's outside my, I don't pay attention to it. So this coalition stuff work was never part of my experience, whereas direct services always has been. Even when I was with a judge, when I was practicing, it was an intense part of my day-to-day. But those coalitions, oftentimes I hear now kind of a discussion that, and it's what I said earlier too, that so much has been invested in direct services, as well as the professionalism of direct services, you know, ensuring that staff and everyone have these degrees and whatever, that we need to undercut all that too. You know, we need to look to a new way, but the problem with that is I still have people who are homeless and I still have people who are hungry and I still have people struggling intensely with emotional and mental health problems. And so talk like that always makes me a little nervous. Similar when I was at Division of Indian Work and people say, you know, that food shelf is just a crutch. You know, you need to shut that down. I was like, well, yeah, but there's still people who are hungry and children who are, I cannot shut that food shelf down. Can't. In fact, the need is even more intense now with the working class than it was, you know, back when I was at DIW and it was mostly just serving homeless.
Is that because of the economic crash?
Yeah, there's a lot of working people. You know, because like I said, recently to live comfortably in the Twin Cities, you have to have a salary of at least $65,000. Most don't. The living wage here, the minimum wage, you need, I think, what is it? You need to work, I want to say at least 1.5, like 60 plus hours just to cover the cost of the apartment, a 2-bedroom. That doesn't include anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, so utilities, food, all of that. So the housing crisis is bad here. That's the strongest need anyone identifies from any of our program. We need housing. We need housing. Yeah, my 80% of my Nokomis clients, homeless, they're bouncing from couch to couch and then they're trying to stay sober, you know. Trafficking, if you really wanted to end sex trafficking, you could. More affordable housing and a living wage. Because if it's a choice between sleeping outside in the winter or sleeping with someone so that my kids and I can sleep at his house, I'm going to sleep with the guy because I don't want my kids to freeze to death. The worst case is when they don't want to sleep with me. They want to sleep with my 16-year-old daughter. And that happens all the time, too. So, yeah. I mean, if you really want to end trafficking or if you want to end a lot of the crime, the drug, I mean, end the conditions that cause it. Don't try to fix people because you can't fix homelessness by the individual, right? If there's no house, there's no house. And so that's probably partly, too, why I'm shifting more into an activist rather than an advocate because it is a bigger thing. I mean, it is impacting everybody and trying to turn the narrative away from this fictitious movie of the week kind of single story of the problem
and trying to get people to understand that, no, it's not kids getting kidnapped out the street. It's not, you know, bad moms. It is long-term oppression, long-term poverty, long-term, you know, mm-hmm. lack of identity, culture.
So do you see yourself moving into that activist role in
this? It's how I raise money, context? Though. It's how I raise money now. I mean, that kind of changing the dialogue is what I do now in this role.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still try to stay as informed as possible and connected with my staff. Because the other thing I don't want to happen, and I think has happened a few times historically with the agency and with other agencies, is the narrative produced by the leader of what's happening and isn't necessarily what's happening at the ground level. And that's easy to happen, because if you're maybe only hearing one story and you kind of blanket over everybody, or you know what you wrote in the grant, you know, but you're not remaining connected with your on the ground people, it's very easy to make that mistake. And it is very important to me that what I say is what's happening here. Otherwise, I'm lying, and I won't do that. I don't care how much money you'll give me. I don't care if you'll give me $1 million if I make up this story about us rescuing some girl from trafficking from the man camps, okay? It doesn't happen that often because kids aren't being kidnapped and taken to the man camps. They're going there willingly because they have no other options, right? That's what I want $1 million is. Let me give them options, not just to make you feel good because you think we've rescued somebody. That's not what's happening.
Well, is there anything that we should talk about that we haven't talked about?
Oh my goodness. That's crazy. I don't think so. I feel like I've not given you much about feminism, though.
That's okay. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, I hadn't really... I think we can turn this off.